This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. It is Thursday, October the 14th. Okay, so have another returning guest. And if you weren't listening, if you weren't a listener of this podcast back on August the 26th of 2020, so a little over a year ago, then you know nothing about the guy that is on the show. Hopefully you listened to it, but if you hadn't, we'll do a quick reintroduction. But Charlie Merrill is on the line. Charlie, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Eddie. Thanks for having me back.
Hey, now remind me, you're in, I think, one of my short list of places that I'd be willing to move to. You're in Colorado, right?
I'm in Boulder, Colorado. We would love to have you move here. I'd love to lift weights with you at some point.
Yeah. it's basically like pretty much anywhere in my state I love, and then there's certain parts of Utah, and then there's like, you know, I did a bunch of off-road motorcycle riding in the summer in central and northern Oregon, and I totally didn't realize how much of a gem that was, and Colorado's also on that list. So you live in a real pretty
gorgeous
place.
I love Oregon.
Yeah,
I love Oregon too. When I need water and I need rain, I go to Oregon.
It was kind of wild. So I rode up Highway 97 when I was coming back up through California and Oregon, and it was kind of like east of Crater Lake, and there's just a bunch of like national forests and forest roads that are single lane that you can take an off-road vehicle on, and they're right along the highway. So like if you're sick of just going 80 miles an hour in a straight line, you can jump off 2 minutes off the freeway and you can do all dirt roads and kind of go through the network of trails and stuff, and that was amazing. I've ridden up Crater Lake before, but I hadn't done any of that off-road stuff. And just the wildfires were a whole nother issue. But it was just, there's a lot of really pretty places on our western side of the United States. I'm sure there are on the eastern side too, but I'm a big fan of the west.
Yes, it's pretty unique up there for sure. Yes. Yeah, those fires were an issue for all of us this summer, weren't they? That was rough.
So Charlie, maybe just take a couple of minutes, kind of tell us where you fall into the, you know, what does your work do when it comes to mind body stuff? Just so people that aren't familiar with you, and talk about your socials as well, because you do a lot of content, at least on Instagram. If they weren't listening a year and change ago, how do you fit into the equation? What do you do?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I'm a physical therapist by training. So the first half of my career was very sort of biomedically body-based. And that means things like manual therapy, trigger point needling, manipulation, you know, looking at biomechanics, especially with athletes, and trying to problem solve, you know, what corrective exercises this person need, how can they move better so that they don't have pain, right? And looking back, you know, I realized that was effective in a lot of cases because, you know, I gave people confidence, I gave them an explanation, and I helped reduce fear.
Yeah.
And we know fear is such a big driver of pain. So I got to the point though, where I realized that I'm missing this whole psychosocial part of the pain experience. And while I thought I did a pretty good job of that, just with my therapeutic alliance and my, you know, relational skills with my clients, you know, there are all these other variables that I was not looking at. And so, since going down that road, I describe it as like this middle way where I hold the body and the mind with equal regard.
Uh-huh.
And so when I'm evaluating somebody, I really feel like it's important to really truly assess their body so that I have more confidence and that they have more confidence that if there is something going on with their body, we're gonna make sure we find it and address it.
Yeah.
If there's not, which is most of the time, we're gonna rule that out. And then we're gonna talk about some of these other things at the same time. So I've worked really hard and like wrestled in my own brain to try to figure out how can I really walk this middle way without doing either one of those an injustice. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like how can I still talk to people about the body and work on the body, even though there's nothing maybe wrong with the body, so that I don't sort of hurt my chances of being able to go down this other psychosocial path with people. And that's been a really wonderful process, challenging process of unlearning a lot of things from the past and then sort of relearning them as I'm learning new things. I guess that's how I describe myself at this point.
It's funny that you use the terminology trigger points earlier, because I just I've got the Time Hop app on my cell phone, and it was on this day 5 years ago that I found the Big Blue Book, the Travell and whoever the other person's name is.
Travell and Simons.
Yeah, Travell and Simons. The blue trigger point book, and I had said, gosh, I forgot, you know what? Where's my Let me tell you the exact caption that I wrote, because this was all before I had any concept of mind body stuff. And at that point in time, Charlie, if I went to see you and you told me that it was, it could be mind body related, I probably would have slapped you in the face. So I said, bought myself this book today, Reading to Better Myself and Hopefully Aid in Why I Hurt So Bad. And spoiler, it didn't help me. It actually made me a lot more paranoid, which might have made me hurt even more. You never know. Are there certain, like just over the years, are there certain mentors that as you kind of evolved your, frame of thought or different ways to which you've kind of navigated these waters of kind of balancing that line? Are there certain mentors that have stuck out to you more than others, where you read the works of them or the data that they publish or even the anecdotes that they may write, and you're like, yeah, that makes me think of what I've been doing for the last 20 years completely differently. Is there anybody that can jump out at you when it comes to that?
Yeah, no question. I mean, I'll first say that, like, the first half of my career, a lot of the mentors that I worked with, I still view them as super formative people in my career that really, to this day, I still even use some of those body-oriented strategies on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. Manual therapy folks, people from that world. And there's been this real pendulum swing, right, to the brain being the driver of all symptoms, to the point where, we wonder if there's going to be some swing back to, like, we have a body and a mind, like, let's not now neglect the body completely in preference for just treating the brain. Right. Yeah. So I still really appreciate all my mentors in the manual therapy world. But when I got to the point where, and I'd read John Sarno's book many years ago before even physical therapy school, because I had my own back injury. And that for me was really powerful. And I think I carried that into my work as a physical therapist in some more abstract way. But when I realized I was missing these psychosocial variables, I reached out to a number of people and said, I wonder if anyone's, talking about John Sarno's work and has expanded it and made it more clinically, robust. And, Dr. Howard Schubiner is the first person I connected with. And then from there, the floodgates just open to all of these amazing clinicians like Alan Gordon and David Hanscom, and I'm not going to do all of them justice, but all the people that are speaking at this PPDA conference at the end of the month, Nicole Sachs, Georgie Oldfield. I mean, there's such an incredible list of teachers and thought leaders that are bringing this work out into the world. And it's funny, maybe you feel this way, but I feel like I've known this and I've been immersed in this now for so long, but so many people don't know it yet. And I'm just waiting for that tipping point where, like, it's just, everybody sort of has at least heard of this idea, right?
What, I'd be curious to know, like, as your career has evolved, because I'm sure that you work with, physicians or clinicians of all different shapes, sizes, beliefs, findings, things like that. And certainly, you could go and see two medical doctors with the same degree, and one will tell you that nothing is derived from the mind. Someone else will say a ton is derived from the mind. Where's the division there, and why does it occur? It's like, I'm looking at the list of the people that are going to be a part of this conference, which is October 28th to the 30th. And we'll get into more of that here in a little bit. Like, there's a whole bunch of different, like, David Clark is an MD. Dr. Hanscom is an MD. Schechter, Schubiner, like Strax, like, there's a ton of people in here that are medical doctors, but if they were to get in a room with another medical doctor, the two could have a sparring match over their thoughts on this kind of stuff. So what's the division? Like, what is the sense of the division, and why wouldn't one side or more doctors maybe buy into this? That's one thing that I hear very commonly from people that reach out to me, is that they've seen so many doctors and they just can't seem to find one that necessarily believes that mind body stuff can have really any sort of an impact on tissues. Maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. As you said, we have people that come from, that were spine surgeons that are doing this work now, yep. Gastroenterologists, internal medicine doctors, physiatrists. There's a wide spectrum of specialties that have, like me, sort of realized that they can have a bigger impact if they're thinking about this differently. I think they're doing that in spite of their training. And I'd like to think that because physicians are so focused on the biomedical piece, which is really important in its own right, especially when you really need that. They get so little training in pain. And I would almost say that 20 years ago, there really wasn't that much great science and understanding of how pain worked. And so this paradigm shift has come really fast. And the clinician community that's been, you know, practicing medicine for 5 or 10 or 20 years, you know, they're in that belief system, right? That old belief system, and they haven't yet discovered maybe that there's another way to think about it. And what I think is really cool is, especially the physicians that are more open to this, they're so, when they discover this, they're so happy and relieved and empowered that there's another explanation that starts to make sense.
Yeah.
Instead of there just being these parts of the elephant, they're seeing, wow, there's a whole elephant. Like, now I can see the whole thing, and this all falls into place. All these answers that I didn't, all these questions that I didn't have answers to, all of a sudden, you know, are really clear. And so there's this like sense of relief. And I think that's why all of these early adopters, these clinicians that you're talking about, have really basically left their traditional practices to go do this work. We could get into the, you know, talking about the medical industrial complex and how it's set up, but maybe that gets a little too political. I'll let you decide that, Eddie.
Yeah. I don't know if we need to go down that road. One thing that's one thought this is making me think of though, as you're kind of talking about that, you know, raises new questions, kind of has, I'm getting the sense of, well, let me give you an example. So I met a little over three years ago, I went and met Dr. Hanscom at the Washington Athletic Club, and we did our sit down in person interview, which was awesome. And my podcast did not have much listenership at the time. In fact, I'd be pretty happy if I could have 100 or 200 people listen to it every month. And now it's 10 or 15,000 that are listening to it every month. But the episode that Hanscom was on, suddenly it got a lot of attention, a lot of people listening to it. And the sense that I got, because he had written his book a few years earlier, but one comment that he made was that there has more has come out in the last year about mind-body symptoms and chronic pain and such than had come out, you know, the previous 50 years combined. It was some kind of a stat like that. And the sense that I got was a guy that did this purely physical spine surgery. And these are all my words, by the way. He didn't say any of this stuff. This is just the sense that I got. He had done the spine surgeon purely physical model for so many years. I mean, he was probably 70 when I met with him. So you're talking probably at least 40 years in practice. And just in the last handful of years prior had come to know this mind-body approach and started seeing dramatically better results by treating people that way. And I saw this guy that had the energy not of a 70-plus-year-old guy about to retire, almost like a full rejuvenation. Is that at all, and if you don't have any examples, that's fine, and I don't even need names, but have there been any people it could even be like doctors, athletes, other physical therapists, chiropractors, whatever, people that have been doing this for so long, and then they kind of maybe skip into this biopsychosocial model, and it seems like maybe their whole attitude, demeanor, level of excitement has changed. Because that was the sense I really got when I sat down with Dr. Hanscom.
Yeah, he's a great example of someone that's just so passionate and, as you know, so prolific in writing about this and sharing about this. And what a shift he's made, right? Yeah. From almost one extreme to the other. Brad Fanistel, who runs the Boulder Center for Mind-Body Medicine, you know, he started that clinic after coming back from a Dr. Schubiner training, and he was so fired up about the idea of having some new things to share that it almost like, you know, I don't know how close he was to retiring, but it sparked a whole nother phase of his career.
Yeah.
He's been totally energized around it. So yeah, there's no question that people that are open to the idea dive right in full force. As you were talking, I realized though, you know, just like when people are in pain, there's this normal fear that comes up around change and sort of an attachment sometimes to what's familiar. And I think the same thing interestingly plays out with clinicians. There's a fear, right, that prevents them from opening up and trying this out. And there's more of an attachment to what's familiar and what they know, because, you know, especially if you spend 6, 8, 12 years learning something in medical school.
Oh yeah.
It's hard to abandon that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So talk about just that, because I'm very curious on, when there's been a big separation of time. If I'm bringing a guest back and there's been a big separation of time from our previous interview to now, one thing I'm always curious about is there any developments? It's probably too dramatic, but have there been any changes or developments or anything that anything maybe new that you've learned or gotten a different perspective on in this kind of stuff in the last 14 months since the last time that we would have met?
That's a cool question. Like a lot of the things that we talked about last time have been reinforced and strengthened
Right.
by the emerging evidence. For instance, maybe when we last talked, we had a lot of information about MRI of the lumbar spine and cervical spine and how we'd see, with high frequency changes on MRI scan that didn't correlate with pain, right? These studies looked at pain-free people that had, a lot of degenerative disease and disc herniations and bulges on their MRI scan, even though they had no pain. We've since sort of started to see people sharing these results from all different parts of the body, from plantar fasciitis to, labral tears in the shoulder, rotator cuff tears, similar in the hip, knee arthritis. And so it's sort of strengthened this idea that the MRI scan isn't as predictive as it was. So I think in that regard, it's been reassuring. And I think that's why this work is growing, because we just have so much more evidence that's emerged in the last even couple of years. I've been really looking hard at this idea of therapeutic alliance and building a relationship with people, building trust, listening skills, and as a clinician, the skills around, doing an interview as a way to help shift belief. And that is just as important part of the process, if not more, and how good I am at psychoeducating around pain science. Turns out that relationship is sort of the foundation for everything else. The one thing maybe we talked about last time, Eddie, was, and I feel like I'm a little bit of an outlier this way at this point, is that I see a lot of people in my practice with acute pain, like pain that just came on in the last days or weeks. These aren't people that have been pained for 3 or 6 months or more, where it's tipped over into chronicity. And I continue to see and continue to understand that even people with new pain, these people are just as likely to have psychosocial triggers and drivers as people in chronic pain. There's this assumption that the word acute means tissue damage, and we even see that play out in the research. But really, acute just means that the symptoms just started. This is a time domain, not a mechanism. And so when I get someone like I had last week, who this guy came in with Achilles tendon pain that had been going on for about 3 or 4 weeks. And he was about 5 days away from running the rim to rim to rim across the Grand Canyon and back. This is on foot, right? So this is in 1 day, 45 miles, thousands of feet of elevation change. Gorgeous. And he'd been training for this and was really motivated. And as happens a lot with runners, in his last sort of tester run, last long run to see how he was feeling, he went out and did like a 35-mile trail run up in the mountains. And he had a really hard day, and it was really frustrating and almost discouraging. And no surprise, that's when his Achilles tendon started to hurt. So I'm seeing him a few days before he's supposed to leave, evaluate him, basically super clear that he doesn't have an Achilles tendonitis or an inflammatory problem with his Achilles, even though he has pain that's very real, and he couldn't run at all at that point. So he's thinking of abandoning this thing, and we really dug down into, what's his psychology around this run? What's his motivation? What are the feelings that are coming up around success and failure? How does this play into his self-esteem, for instance, his relationships? What's the meaning of this event for him? And we arrived at a point where he understood that he really wanted to do this. Like, he was doing it for what he felt like were the right reasons. He was really excited about it, really motivated. And I just gave him, basically said, "Your body looks great. I give you the green light this week to start, testing the waters, and I think you're going to be just fine." And he was. And he went out and did the whole thing, didn't have Achilles pain, you know, a few days after he and I met, just a single time. And so I thought it was such a great example of an acute pain phenomenon in an athlete that's doing things that most people would write off as like, this guy's just overtraining. He's running too much, you know? But really it was just his big feelings about this thing that he put so much time and energy into. And it was really scary for him to think that he might have to abandon it and not get to do it.
Are there, let's say in that, cause I'm really curious on that exact scenario. Cause that's like, you know, that's a big deal. Somebody's training for something, presumably for a very long time, and they come in to see you. Are there certain things that like will tip you off that says, hey, meaning in your head, hey, Charlie, as you're talking to yourself, this is likely a
mind, I do that a lot.
Yeah, this is a likely, me too. This is likely a mind-body thing, but this guy is looking for my advisement about whether or not he should do this. Like, are there certain things that tip you off just in the first couple of minutes where you're like, I don't know if this is an Achilles thing and I think he should do this, meaning in your own head? Like, because I imagine if you don't have any background on them or you don't know them very well, like, is there anything in the first couple of minutes that they may say or do or the way they explain the injury or things like that that kind of tip you off that this is likely, you know, this is likely a mind-body thing that you're going to treat as such?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know, in this specific case, one of the things that came up that I think he said a few times early in our conversation is that he wasn't an athlete, that he somehow like wasn't a real runner, or that, you know, he was sort of downplaying the fact that he deserved to do this. It's kind of what I was hearing. And right away it kind of tips you off to like, dude, you're running across the Grand Canyon and back. This is such a Boulder, Colorado phenomenon, by the way. People are so fit and they're so active and they're so strong, and yet they're comparing themselves to others, right? Yeah. And there's like this feeling of like, maybe I'm not worthy of doing this. And I don't make the assumption that that's their underlying feeling, but that's a good example of a little sign. Sometimes there's a something that comes up in the conversation about something stressful that's going on in their life with their kids or their partner or financially or with their work. That's made it more complicated for them to train, let's say, and they would never make that connection between that and their Achilles pain necessarily. Or there's something that stands out like a symptom behavior. It's one of our favorite ways to help make this or move us in the direction of this diagnosis is that, the pain is really inconsistent. It kind of like doesn't come on during the run, but it comes on later or the next day. Or this run feels fine and that run didn't feel great. And it depends on context. You know, there's no obvious mechanism of injury. Like there's nothing that happened. There wasn't like a slip or a fall or an ankle sprain or something that might lead to, you know, an inflammatory tendonitis. And so you're sort of compiling all of this, and you're right. The relational part of this allows us to get to the underlying things a little bit more quickly. Yeah. And if we're really listening to what the person's saying, we start to get a sense for a while, like, you know, this guy's success or failure in this event is really going to predict his self-esteem, or he's putting a lot of pressure on himself at this point after 6 months of training for this, an excessive amount of pressure to do this event. Or I can tell that he has just a little bit of underlying anxiety, just in general. And that sort of tips me off too. I wonder how that shows up in the face of his running and in his training and in this goal in particular. So yeah, there's a lot of evidence that comes up even as you said, in the first 5 minutes, that you just build on from there.
I kind of feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, I've kind of had this theory. I don't know if I've ever even talked about this in the podcast before, but I've kind of had this theory for a long time that, well, let me back up. There was a executive that worked for my wife's company a few years ago, and he was really into CrossFit and being an athlete. And I was telling him that, and one thing that he did is that he would personally pay discount, or he would subsidize a large portion of gym dues for his employees to go to this particular CrossFit gym that was right near the place, and would encourage everybody to like go to the class together and do all this. And I remember I asked him about it. because I also did it too, even though I didn't work for him. It was like a company barbecue or something. And I asked him, like, you know, why is that? I wish my company did something like that. And he said that he just finds far better performance out of his employees if they engage in some kind of a sport or some kind of something to really push themselves. And in the subsequent years since, especially as I've gotten into this mind body stuff, part of me is thinking, like, gosh, it would seem that athletes would be highly susceptible to have, you know, kind of this unconscious constant anxiety, like they would be really prone to having mind body issues. And then further, I would almost think that executives and people in high ranking business positions would have the exact same thing, because even if they don't engage as an athlete, because by proxy, they are probably highly competitive. They're probably in a highly stressful environment, you know, what kind of all these things that sort of shape their psychology. It's just something that I've given a lot of thought to, like, and I think the problem with it, if you find this to be true, that athletes inherently are great poster children for mind body issues, that it's like a catch 22, because it's very easy to be told, like, oh yeah, you overtrained, or you ran too much, or this is a stress injury or whatever, when really it's like a mind body issue, but it's really easy to be fooled as an athlete because you're almost too in tune with your body. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I always tell my athletes that, you know, they're the most prone to this type of pain, that pain is the best way to get an athlete's attention, because it threatens the thing they love to do the most, as you said.
Yeah.
And there are definitely pre-existing personality traits, like high achievement, as one example that I think you mentioned, expecting a lot of yourself, being driven. And those personality traits set up our nervous system, sort of prime our nervous system to do this, as opposed to pain that comes from tissue damage or some type of injury, which in my experience, in my practice, which is filled with a lot of athletes, the primary pain, the brain-driven symptoms, are far more common than anything body damage-wise. And I think we don't give ourselves enough credit for just how durable and robust the human body is. And I'm surrounded by people that are doing these amazing things every day, you know, lifting tremendous amounts of weight, running incredible distances. You're right. There's a default to, well, because you're doing those things, you must be damaging your body. There must be wear and tear. Maybe you did that for too long.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you've been doing this for too many years and you need to give it up. But that's, like, you know, almost never the case in my experience.
It's something I've been like, so lately, cause I'm, so in the weightlifting world, like the Olympic weightlifting world, I'm considered, what we call a master, which means I'm just old as shit basically. And, so I compete if you look at, like, the nationals qualifying totals, the moment you turn 35, they dramatically drop, in terms of the amount of total, which is your snatch plus your clean and jerk. And so the amount of weight that you would need to hit in order to qualify for a national meet goes down dramatically when you're 35, which I'm sure there's something to that. And that's really the case. And, you know, maybe muscle tissue, maybe it does diminish and all that kind of stuff and whatever at 35. Although I think that's kind of young for any of that stuff to really be true. But psychologically speaking, for me as an athlete, and this doesn't exactly fall in specifically to the kind of stuff that we're talking about, Sarno-esque and Schubiner-esque, but mind to body connection, a lot of times, like, I'll feel like I kind of go on this couple week run of, gosh, the weights just feel so much heavier, I must be getting weaker, I'm getting older, all of this. And then, like, a certain cue comes to mind, or, you know, put my feet a couple inches closer together and point my knees more out when I'm doing the first pull in a snatch or clean and jerk, and suddenly the bar feels lighter and everything. Like, is it the cue, or is it the fact that I think the cue's going to work? And that's something that I just kind of have fun in my own mind about, where, like, is it the chicken or the egg? Is it the cue itself, or is it just the fact that, you know, in my mind I'm thinking of something and then it's actually happening? I don't know. That might have been total nonsense to you, but it's a thought. As time goes on, I kind of feel like this mind body stuff is really more the mother load than even I had considered it to be in the past few years.
And I guess the bigger question is, does it really matter whether it's, you know, your intention or your belief in the intention? Does it really matter at the end of the day?
Yeah,
there's definitely a change in.
Yeah, to me, it only matters if I want to, like, get into coaching down the road and sound like I know what I'm talking about. That's kind of the only piece there.
I hear you. I understand that. I'm a big believer in the power of intention with movement. And I don't, you know, you can call it a placebo, but a placebo doesn't mean it's fake or it's not real or it's not working.
Yep.
It has some type of, you know, physiologic effect on the nervous system, on the brain, and thus on the performance of the muscle. Right. So we'll come back to this idea that we have to hold the body and the mind with equal regard. Even though the brain is in charge, we still have to respect that there's an output, there's a change in output. An athlete is kind of what you're describing.
Yeah.
If you buy into the idea that we lose, correct me if I'm wrong, 1% of our muscle mass per year after a certain age, that's sort of the average loss objectively of the amount of muscle mass. It doesn't really explain the drop off in performance as you're describing at the age of 35. That said, if we look at things like people are having kids, people are getting deeper into their career, they have more stress in their lives, they're in a more committed relationship that has its own challenges at times. I would guess that those factors are far more predictive of the drop off in performance, even simply because of a decrease in the amount of time you have to train compared to when I was in my 20s, right? Yep. Than any, you know, physiologic body changes that could be happening. I'm curious to hear what you think about that.
I've had that thought actually fairly recently. I think you're completely right. I think that you're totally right. And because the amount of strength that I have post Sarno, even though my years cumulatively have gone up and I am older, I am stronger than I was, you know, I'm stronger at 35 than I was at 25. So, however, I was less strong at 30. So like, than I was maybe at 27, 28, 29. And so how do you explain that? Well, I had, you know, I had my first kid when I was 28 or 29 and, you know, but then I found Sarno when I was 31 or so. And then you just kind of have these subsequent years of more and more strength. And I think a lot of it just comes down to an overall level of confidence that I have in my engine, my car not breaking down, being able to run, you know, go out to your car and make sure that it turns over for 300,000 miles without an issue. Like that's more of how I see myself now versus just this thing that has a shelf life that eventually is going to break down. And I think that in a lot of ways, like athletes sort of feel that way. There, it's amazing the amount of people that I'm connected with on Instagram and different social media sites, people that I trained with or observed from afar that I had so much respect for because of how much grit they had when it came to training. And then suddenly now, like they're in their mid 30s and they're getting a ton of injuries. And yeah, maybe that's possible. But I also see them buying houses and I see them having kids and I see them getting promotions at work and all this stuff. And surely that's not a coincidence, like you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, sounds like we need to do a study. I think there's just some great connections.
Yeah.
I have no doubt that there's something there. I think it's really interesting the way you just shared some of those observations. Definitely something there, and I think it's worth staying curious about. And
What one thing that I'm kind of curious about, since you do have a, you know, kind of an athletic, like I'm on your website right now, mperformance.com, as in Merrill performance.com. Athletes, I assume, are probably the highest demographic of the people that you work with, if not all. And is there, you know, somebody comes into your clinic, they know nothing about mind, body, anything. They just think they have tendonitis or, you know, kind of rattle off whatever it could be. You work with them on this kind of stuff. They buy into it. Is there then, like, are you diminishing your own business and they never return, or there's nothing really for them to do after the fact? Or are there certain things that you give them as kind of like a maintenance plan that's more of a mind body thing, whether it's, you know, make sure that you do these breathing exercises once a week, or make sure that you do journaling every other day, or make sure you do meditation? Like, is there any certain things in the Charlie Merrill playbook that are more mind body derived that you, you know, you sort of give to people as continued education? Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Well, one of the things I love so much about this work is that you're really teaching people skills that they can carry forward into their life, whether they're an athlete or not. And I don't, you know, I see a lot of athletes, but I see more and more, I see a lot of people that are dealing with chronic pain too, that have become scared of movement. Regardless, my goal has always been to get people to move through my practice and get back to living their lives. Right. I don't, I don't see a lot of value or a lot of benefit in getting people attached or dependent on what I'm doing. But that said, what I like to do is separate our work on trying to help them unlearn or cure their pain from the idea of performance. So if someone's an athlete, I still see an opportunity to work with them on things that will help their performance that are body and mind related, even beyond them, you know, getting over their pain. And you know this as well as I do. The reality is we all have pain. Like, the goal is not to get rid of pain completely. Who is it that says those are dead people's goals? Like, we can't get rid of feelings and we can't get rid of pain. So people always come back. And in fact, I would almost argue that they're more likely to come back and continue to grow in their lives as people if you teach them these skills, because it's going to show up somewhere else next time, or they're going to have some new condition. So, you know, if I see people twice a year, 3-4 times a year, that's not unusual. And maybe I see them once and then they move on. But, you know, what's the statistic? 1 in 4 people in the world are struggling with pain, with chronic pain at a given time. That's a huge number. 25% of people, there's no limit to, you know, to the opportunities as a clinician to be able to support those people. It just maybe is not supporting the same people over and over again. It's more this sort of steady flow, which I think is super rewarding, of just touching more and more people's lives over time and teaching them about this. That's been my experience as a clinician.
Do you find yourself people that come in for a second time? So let's say Johnny is your client. Johnny comes in for the first time to ever see you. Johnny's got a back problem, or a backache or a back injury. You go through the biopsychosocial model, mind body, his back pain goes away. 6 or 9 or 12 months later, or 2 years later, whatever the case is, Johnny comes back, Johnny's foot hurts or his ankle hurts or something like that. And he's sure that it's a mind body thing. And you're like, are you sure that this isn't just the, you know, the mind body stuff that we went through with your back a year or two ago? And then kind of go through the same process, boom, the knee or foot pain or whatever is gone. Like, because I found myself getting tricked in the last couple of years, and my wife will just simply point that out, just say the sentence. What if this is like, you know, one of those Sarno things, I think is what she calls it. And inevitably, there's been a couple of times, like one was, I was positive I had COVID and my symptoms went away in an hour or two after she had said, what if this is one of those Sarno things? And the symptoms went away, right? So like, I get tricked. Do you have people that come in and see you that they, you know, they're a repeat client or customer, so to speak, and they've simply been tricked, and then you've helped remedy them again?
Oh yeah, all the time. Yeah, I mean, there are patterns that show up. I see people that come in, and I'm like, hey, you were here exactly this time last year. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Let's start to see if there's a pattern going on. Or, you know, we start talking, and we realize that like they're in another phase of like a deadline at work. And we're starting to notice this pattern and build a case over the course of time. And sometimes you can't do that the first time you see them. Maybe they get better too fast. Mm-hmm. But as you engage with them more, you're starting to really make meaning, which I think is the ultimate goal, out of some of these symptoms. This is what the brain wants, right? The brain is trying to keep us safe. That's its whole job. And sometimes it's really hard, especially as an athlete, to interpret the meaning to say, oh, my knee hurts. How does that connect to my work or to my relationships or to moving, you know, to this change in my life, for instance? And you can do that over the course of time with people and start noticing patterns. That said, there are people that have come in, and the first time I see them, they have, you know, something that's more psychosocially driven. The next time they come in, maybe there's something that's going on with their body. And if I assume that it's a psychosocial, you know, primary pain, brain-driven problem, I might miss something.
Yeah.
So for me, as a body-oriented clinician, I really take it seriously that I have to evaluate the body, and I have to feel confident for me and for them that we can move forward in this new way. And there have been times when I said, you know, people come back with a sprained ankle. I'm like, you sprained your ankle. You know, it's going to take a few weeks to feel better. Or, you know, something did happen, and I say, hey, you need to go see the orthopedist this time. One of the things that I'm going to talk about in my 30-minute session at the conference is this idea that my colleagues, Lerma Mosley, David Butler, Adrian Lowe, the people that have been driving pain neuroscience education as a tool, They apply this with everybody, regardless of what's causing their pain. So even people that are that had surgery or had a traumatic injury or had a car accident, they're still using these psychosocial strategies to help them recover more quickly and have a more complete recovery and not end up in chronic pain. And I won't spoil all the things I'm going to talk about, but these two worlds, the PPDA, Psychophysiologic Disorders Association, and my colleagues are sort of coming together and meeting in this really beautiful way, where I think we can start to think of these ideas not just in a dualistic way where we're just applying them to chronic pain in certain circumstances, but we're able to sort of apply them in some way to everybody, because everybody has, you know, psychological and social factors that play into their pain. Sometimes it's just fear of the pain itself, and sometimes it's things that are totally outside of the realm of what most of us think drive pain, like some of the things we've been talking about. And so my colleagues could do well to look at those other factors outside of pain. And the people that are talking about primary pain and trying to create a more of a dualistic equation would do well to take some of those strategies and apply them to other people. And even look at things like movement, like you and I do day to day in our lives, as a way to really create a hedge against, you know, pain and other disease.
I want to wrap up plugging what is coming up, because you just alluded to it, 30-minute set coming up for the virtual conference. One thing that I was thinking of, because Sundays for me personally typically are sitting in front of NFL Red Zone and seeing, you know, play after play after play after play after play for hours on end. And when I see players get injured or different things like that, like I very much, not necessarily in a game, but if it, you know, midweek, somebody's having soreness or issues or they're going to be out or whatever, I find myself armchair quarterbacking a lot with, is that real or did it happen? Did it happen in a game? Like Russell Wilson just tore this tendon in his middle finger, and like it looked gruesome, and it was literally his middle finger was like crooked and pointing and all this kind of stuff, and now he's going to be out for 4 to 6 weeks. That's different than, you know, a mind-body approach that we might think about something else. Do you find yourself seeing professional athletes in that way like I do? Like a good example is Tiger Woods. Ever since I read the Sarno books, that was one of the first people that I thought of. Peyton Manning in a lot of ways, Eli Manning in some ways. Like, are there athletes or athletic cases where you kind of see, you know, as a person that does what you do and works with who you do, do you find yourself doing armchair quarterback stuff on athletes that appear on the news or ESPN as having some kind of issues or ongoing things? Does that make sense?
Yes, no question. I think that, you know, the armchair quarterbacking is a funny term, because I don't know any playmaking in football. I appreciate football, but
yeah,
I don't know anything about the actual, you know, technical details of playing professional football.
Yeah.
But from a healthcare clinician perspective, absolutely. And the most recent example is Scottie Pippen in the documentary, yeah, The Last Dance, yep, about the Chicago Bulls team. And, you know, he had back pain. It was really holding him back late in his career. And if you watch that, you'll see the stress that he went through on that team and as an athlete. And to me, there's no question that if he had known about this and if he'd been exposed to this work back then, that he probably would have had a lot less back pain. So yeah, but even in your example that you shared of the crooked finger, you can imagine there's some healing that's going to happen.
Yep.
And just like we don't give the body enough credit that it's strong and robust, most people don't know how well the body heals and how reliable that is.
Yep.
And so, you know, he'd have less fear if he understood the details of how his body's going to heal, and he'll be fine. He'll be playing football again. But there's also the psychological and social strains of how does this affect his, you know, how's he being viewed by the coaches and his teammates? And what does this mean for his future? You know, the brain quickly takes us down this rabbit hole of fear, and the sequelae or the consequences of an injury like that are not just physical. And so the people in his training room really could be supporting him with some of these fears and other emotions like grief and sadness and anger that are going to, of course, come up in the face of an injury like this. I mean, this is his livelihood, right? This is what he does. He depends on it. So I think that's a missed opportunity with athletes.
Yeah. There's an interesting reason or thing that I'm thinking of. So I lift for, there's a pretty well-known Olympic weightlifting club. They're out of Oregon, Catalyst Athletics, and the two coaches are Greg and Amy Everett. And Amy Everett is actually the first female coach to ever coach a U.S. Olympic weightlifter in the Olympics. And it happened in Tokyo just now, 2021. So she coached Maddie Rogers, so she's the first female coach ever. The guy, Greg, is my coach, and he posted this question on Instagram. Let me see if I can find it. He said, what's been your biggest mistake in weightlifting, and what did you do or are you doing about it? And I'm scrolling through the comments, and there's a lot of them. I mean, there's probably, there's hundreds in here at least. There's probably more. And they all kind of fit around, like, everybody's. It is thinking that master's training was easy. My biggest mistake was waiting too long. My biggest mistake was going too heavy. My early arm bend and snatches, like, it's all of this certain, you know, type of a framing. Mine, which it only got an acknowledgement from the coach. Nobody else said anything about it, which is, it always cracks me up that, you know, sort of the mind body thought is
they just ignore it.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah. But my response was, honestly, when I destroyed my shoulder at the end of 2015 and I had my labrum and my rotator cuff repaired, the grief of losing my sport and seemingly all of my hobbies really impacted me like a real trauma. I didn't take it seriously at all. And if I could go back in time, I would have absolutely sought the support of a therapist at the time if I could. Because that's the stuff that I think of now where it was like, okay, I dislocated my shoulder, I tore my labrum, I tore my rotator cuff. Maybe it was a mind-body thing, but regardless of what it was, I was still, my two biggest passions, which are weightlifting and motorcycle riding, both were done for a year. I was 29 turning 30. So I was 29 when it happened. I was 30 by the time I had surgery. And then you have the months after that you're doing the rehab and, you know, jarring of motorcycle riding and riding off road and all that kind of stuff is just not conducive to rehab on a shoulder. So that's something I thought about a lot. Like, would I have had so many subsequent pain issues if I would have had the foresight to seek out a therapist, like a psychologist while I was going through this stuff and just have them literally just say to me, Eddie, like, this is a big deal. You know, I know you're moving on with life like nothing happened and you're still doing all these things and raising your kid and trying to be the best at work and all that kind of stuff. But like, you know, this is a sign something happened and just acknowledge that those feelings are there. I think really could have changed a lot for me when I think back on it. So that's when he talks about biggest regret in weightlifting or things that you wish you could take back. For me, that's paramount.
Yeah, that's a beautiful insight. I appreciate you sharing that. And yeah, injuries are, as you said, psychologically really challenging. And would you have had a better outcome? I don't know. I mean, it sounds like you've done a great job, and it's a testament to how well the body heals, right? And how robust we are and how you've gotten back to it.
Yeah.
And now you're doing the work. So that's really what matters at the end of the day. I think even in some of the other comments you shared, you know, one was around, I wish I'd started earlier. Like, that person is thinking physiologically, if I'd started younger, I would have had more muscle mass. I would have better connective tissue, tensile strength, all those things. But really wrapped up in that also is regret and self-judgment and other psychological factors that probably that person carries with them day to day that probably holds them back performance wise. So they even have an opportunity to look at those things in the present moment. And if that's their goal, to really address some of those things and maybe let those thoughts go, because they're maybe not true and maybe not helpful, you know?
So kind of as we wrap up, so just kind of give us the skinny on this virtual conference. Can Joe Schmo attend, or is this only for experts? Or talk about who can attend and where they can find more info.
Yeah, well, you and I want to make sure that everybody knows about this. And I think what I love about the PPDA is they encourage any clinician, any person to come and learn about the current state of this paradigm shift. I always say we need an army of educators, and that includes anybody who is willing to sort of share the truth about pain out into the world. So yes, anybody can come. It's October 28th through 30th. It'll be live, but also on demand. If you sign up, you'll have access to the video content for a year. Clinicians can get continuing education credits for attending. There's actually a separate sign-up link. And maybe what I'll do is I'll share those two sign-up links with you, Eddie, so you can put them in the show notes so people can go in and sign up. It's an amazing group of clinicians. This is the largest mind-body conference in history, and I expect this is just the start, but it's just an incredible group of people, and I just feel honored and humbled to be included. So I hope some of your viewers will show up.
It really is a who's who, people, as you're listening to this. I told Charlie, I can't remember if I messaged you or if I commented when you'd posted about it, but 9 of the people of this massive group, which it looks like is only about a third of the speakers, certainly half at least, are people that I've interviewed on the show. So if you've listened to episodes with Dr. David Clark, Dr. Eileen Feinblatt, Dr. David Hanscom, Charlie Merrill, Christy Weepy, Jessica Shahinian, Howard Schubiner, Dr. Schechter, Nicole Sachs, they've all been on my podcast at some point. And so if you listen to those episodes and you really like them, this is a great opportunity to hear more from them and a lot more people. And then even further, if you decide to attend this or watch it on demand and you really liked what all of them said, just know there are hours. There's at least 10 hours between those, but probably more like 13 to 15 hours of additional content you could find on this podcast simply by going there. I'll link this, by the way, but it's on the front page of ppdassociation.org.
Eddie, your podcasts are so good too. They're just so rich with conversation. I just always appreciate the way you talk with people. We're trying as a collective to really shift the way we look at pain and really have create a positive change in the medical system to work on what I think is one of the biggest problems in society, which is that 1 in 4 people are in pain in their lives. And really, this is an opportunity to really create a lot of change, positive change for people in their lives.
Yeah.
And that there's a lot of meaning there for all of us. So I appreciate you creating a forum to talk about it, Eddie.
Certainly. Charlie, thanks for joining us again. We went a few minutes over what I told you we would, but we appreciate having you back. And maybe this is something that we'll do, once a year or something like that. It's been 14 months since the last one. Maybe we'll get a 2022 visit. How's that sound?
I'll keep studying and learning and innovating. And I'd love to talk with you again.
Perfect. Charlie, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Eddie. Talk soon.